This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.
Babel a Haclia, a three-part series that will illustrate the multilingual past and present of our capital city. In this first program, we will listen to a roundtable that took place in Near FM with a group of educators with first-hand experience of the different languages spoken in Dublin. The participants are TCU Professor Dr. Michael Cronin, Gael School Barra Teacher Dr. A. O'Martin, Primary School Principal Dr. Deidre Kirwan, and Mary Ryan, a former Assistant Principal in Castleknock Community College. All of them with a keen interest in language and integration issues.
We will start the program with an historical overview of how Dublin has been exposed to many different languages over history. Michael.
Well, it's kind of interesting if we look at the name of the city of Dublin. We already have two names for it. We've got Ballyachlia in Irish and we've got Dublin in English. I mean, the first settlement we're aware of is the one that was around the Black Pool, which is situated somewhere near the park where the Chester Beatty is now in Dublin. So we know there was a settlement there. It was a trading settlement. Already the first name outside of Ireland that we find for the city of Dublin is Eblana, and Eblana is a kind of corruption of Dublin, of Deblana. When the Vikings come to Ireland and bring with them Old Norse and set up a kind of a settlement from 841 AD onwards, this word Dublin, they call it Duevlin, if you like. They try to translate this Dublin into Old Norse and it becomes Duevlin. When the Anglo-Normans come after the surrender of the city of Dublin in 1170, they see the name Dublin, and in Irish there's a dot over the B to indicate there's a H coming after the B. It's a kind of classic thing you used to find even in textbooks years ago. But that diacritic didn't exist in Norman, so they called it Dublin. They couldn't pronounce, or they weren't aware of the fact that the dot indicated the H. So if you like, already what we're finding in the very origins of the city of Dublin is the kind of the traces of these different languages. So initially we have the Irish language, which is spoken in this settlement. It's an early Christian monastery, which is situated around where the site of the St. Valentine's Church is in Ainger Street. And this was the Balliol, the Cahir, because, you know, the monastic settlements, they were the first kind of settlements approximated to urban settlements in Irish life. So this became the Balliol Achlia, because it was the ford of the reeds, the yellow reeds. So this settlement had Irish and Latin. Then, of course, when the Vikings come to bring with them Old Norse, they begin to introduce words, first in place names, you know, Hoth, which is Huvud, means head in Old Norse. We've got places like Skerries, Skerri, Skirren in modern Swedish, which is the word for reefy islands. So what they're beginning to do then is to leave their traces of their language in place names, but they're also beginning to bring words into the Irish that's used in Dublin, because we have the two languages, if you like, coexisting side by side. We've got Old Norse and Irish. So it's kind of interesting that the word that's often used in English to talk about somebody who speaks an Irish accent years before was brogue. Somebody spoke with a brogue, coming from the, you know, Irish brogue for shoe. But of course, that word came into Irish from Old Norse brog, which was the Old Norse word for a shoe, because one of the important factors of the Norse presence was, of course, trading. Mardaga, market in Irish, comes from Old Norse. So a lot of the trading terms and, of course, the nautical terms that we have, you know, ship, a long, long shift, the long boat, comes from Old Norse, that the coming into Irish. So what we find then in the city of Dublin is that we've got Irish, we've got Latin, we've got Old Norse that are coexisting side by side. So when Dublin surrenders, for example, to the Norman French in 1170, the man who negotiates is a man called Maurice Regan, who is the interpreter for Diarmaid MacMurrough. But Maurice Regan was an interpreter between French and Irish. These negotiations were carried on through Irish, because the Norman French, of course, spoke no Irish. So when the Norman French come in then, for two centuries or more, the main, if you like, legal and administrative and ecclesiastical language of the city of Dublin is going to be Norman French. For example, we have two ways of saying Dorset Street or Dorset Street. The two contrasting pronunciations are to do with the presence of a Norman French-speaking population in the city of Dublin right up until the sort of the conquest or the reconquest of Ireland in the 16th century, when, of course, another language or another version of a language comes in, because English, of course, is spoken in the city of Dublin throughout the medieval period, but it's a particular kind of version of English. A lot of it is a dialect of Middle English, which survives in the Fingal area, became known as Fingalian. But it's an English that when the New English, as they're called, arrive from the kind of 1540s onwards, they find it quite incomprehensible too. It's rather like the difference between, say, for example, French spoken in Quebec and the French spoken in metropolitan France. It sounded to the New English as strange as Quebec French sounds to a lot of metropolitan French speakers. And then, of course, as we go into the 17th and 18th and 19th century, we're getting German merchants, Italian traders, we're getting the Huguenots who are arriving after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in 1685. So you see the names Latouche Hotel and Greystones, Latouche family, Huguenot origin, one of the people set up the Bank of Ireland. Something they're probably going to forget nowadays. And then we see we come to late 19th century, early 20th century, Jewish community begins to expand after the pogroms in Russia, so that in 1902, election literature has been produced in Yiddish for James Connolly, as it would be in 1912 when he's going for election as well for the Irish Republican Socialist Party. They're Yiddish leaflets that are produced for the Yiddish-speaking community in Dublin. So I suppose it's important to remember about the historical record is that tend to think of Dublin as a city that's become kind of, you know, very multilingual in recent times as a result of changes, particularly from the 1990s onwards. But one of the things I think about the multilingual present of Dublin is to remind us of its multilingual past. And this is one of the reasons why in that opening, the opening pages of Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, the river kind of Liffey, kind of flowing through the city, but he talks about the kind of all these languages, you know, the clap of thunder in 20 languages and on at the bottom of the first page. So it kind of reminds us, I think, of the fact that Dublin has always been a multilingual, has always been a polyglot city.
With that Dublin has been always a multilingual, but the image of Dublin up to around the 20th century was of a monolingual city. That's where I want to bring A coming into Dublin to a city seen as monolingual, coming from a Gaeltacht. How alive was the Irish language in Dublin when you came?
Well, I would have come to Dublin in 1996 to study in College de Oire Marino on Griffith Avenue. And at the time, strangely enough, all of my B.Ed programme there was done through Gaeilge. So most lectures, 90% of them were us Gaeilge at the time. So that kind of created, I suppose, looking back at it now, a kind of a false atmosphere of the Irish language at the time, because most people went to lectures, it was us Gaeilge. But then outside of those lectures and the halls, most people talked English. And it was only after a while, when you developed your friend base and you got to know other people, that, you know, you really saw then what the language was like. Where I came from, a home and a parish and a community what was predominantly Irish speaking. So to come to a city then and to immerse yourself in a new course that was done through Irish, but it was a new Irish and completely different to what I spoke. It was the Cajan. So it was like learning a new language at another level. At the time, you kind of tended to live with those from your own area. Going out at night, you know, it was mostly English. Most places you go to, it was just the language of the city. But on saying that, we would find ourselves, myself and my friends, we would go to certain bars around town because you knew there would be Irish speakers there. The likes of Doyle's Corner. But on a whole, I think Dublin, you know, it is predominantly or was during that period of my life an English-speaking city.
Just on that point, I want to bring Deirdre. You had experience as a principal of a primary school that has gone from monolingual parish school to a plurilingual school. How that has happened and how have you dealt with it? It's a challenge.
Yes, well, I suppose it was very exciting when it happened first. A mixture of excitement and trepidation. In 1994, we were approached at the end of August and asked if we would take a little girl from Bosnia. And of course, we said yes, we would. The teacher who was going to take that little girl into her class was somebody who had quite a lot of experience, somebody who was very committed to what she did. And I'd say that that woman was awake several nights wondering and worrying about what she was going to do with the child in her class who didn't speak English as her first language. But whatever fears and trepidation we had, that little girl proved to be a wonderful ambassador for all of those who would come after her. She was an exotic creature because she was the only person in the school who could speak a language other than English or Irish. And she had quite an outgoing personality. And I mean, I can remember standing in fascination looking at that little girl conversing with her mother on the phone because of some issue or other that might have been going on in school. And this was maybe 4 or 5 months into her time in school. And not in perfect English, but certainly in sufficiently good English, she could then convey to me whatever the conversation was that was going on at home. And as I say, she proved to be a very good ambassador, with the result when we were asked the following year by the Refugee Council if we would take some more programme refugees, we said we would. We took 6. And from that time on, the Dublin 15 area would have quite a lot of people from all over the world coming to settle there. So within a very short period of time, we had a significant number of people from all over the world as part of our enrolment. And having gone from having one child who was a non-native speaker of English in 1994, one child out of approximately 280. Today, 73% of our enrolment comes from various different places around the world. We would have children from more than 40 different linguistic backgrounds in the school. To me, having people from all over the world has brought to our school is a huge vibrancy, a huge amount of, you know, interest in terms of their cultural backgrounds, and particularly in the area of language, because language is ultimately the most important thing if we want children in the educational setting to reach their potential. Is extremely important in terms of their own identity, in terms of their self-esteem, in terms of their heritage.
And that makes sense. And probably it's a little bit easier in primary school than what will be Mary's experience in secondary school. In secondary school, the kids don't have the luxury of having the time to learn the language slowly. They have the junior cert, they have the leaving cert, and they have already their language more settled. If they are monolingual in a language that is not English, how was your experience in secondary school with that type of newcomers, monolingual in a language that they were not English or plurilingual? Lingual in other languages?
Well, funnily enough, our experience was something like Deirdre's. We both work in the Dublin 15 area, so we experienced the challenge very early on in the situation of immigration into Ireland. Students began to trickle into our classrooms, but what happened was one student came who had absolutely not one word of English, and that really was the catalyst for what happened eventually. We sat down and we decided we had to do something to respond to the growing number of immigrants into our school. So we developed a little centre, which we called a language centre, on parallel lines to a learning centre. Most people will be aware of learning centres. And we just ran it on parallel lines to the learning centre. So we withdrew children from their classroom, the mainstream classroom, until they came up to a level where they could actually converse and understand questions and answers and maybe find their way around the school. We could withdraw them for maybe a week or two, and then they would go back into their classroom, and we would draw them maybe for one class period a day or two class periods. It was very convenient when children didn't do Irish, for instance, or didn't do religion. We could withdraw them during that time because we didn't want to take them out of subjects which would be examined later on. So that proved relatively successful. In fact, we felt we were getting places when the department unfortunately started to roll back on the EAL support, or English as an additional language support. So we were a bit like rabbits and caught in headlights in the beginning. We didn't know what to do. But eventually we began to put in place supports. And of course, like Deirdre said, the students added such an amount of wealth to our school in terms of linguistics. We had 35 different languages in our school at one stage, and we tried to exploit those and use them to the advantage of the school.
4 of you are involved in education in one way or the another. Would you say that in general, the inclusion of new students with different languages has been a positive or has been a negative, in a way that it it stops or it slows down the progress of teaching the class in general? What will be your general view?
I think the important thing really to remember is that, and certainly from my experience, because this has happened at third level as well, because, I mean, you know, at different levels these changes have occurred. And at third level, the change has come both from students who are now beginning to come into the system at third level, but also the fact there's been a kind of the internationalisation of education. So you've got exchange students from all over the globe. You know, what's particularly kind of enriching, you know, for the teaching environment is that things that were formerly kind of an abstraction, like if you talked about another culture, another language, or another place, it becomes a tangible kind of living reality. But somebody who literally kind of embodies that language or that culture, that reality. So, and they're bringing things to the kind of classroom experience and making you also self-reflexively think about what you're teaching, because we all have these kind of cultural assumptions. We've got cultural assumptions about humour, you know, telling those. So it's probably not a bad thing. It means you're forced to change your jokes because, you know, they no longer work. The kinds of the reference that you make, kind of historical references, the references you make to particular forms of media, all those things you've got to kind of question yourself about the kind of assumptions that you make about, you know, what is widely shared or universal knowledge and so on. So I think it's something that both you as somebody who teaches, but also the kind of the other students themselves are shaped or changed by the people that they're interacting with. But I think the fundamental thing that I always think needs to be remembered in debates around language and languages is that it's always presented as an either or. This it's something, it seems to me, in the kind of Anglophone mindset that always presents languages in terms of either English or, you know, whereas the both and, what I would call a kind of an analogic rather than a binary approach to things, seems to be so much more enriching. I think it's the thing that bedeviled, for example, debates around bilingualism in Ireland for years was Irish or English, you know, rather than Irish and English. And similarly, I think for in terms of multilingualism, to see these things as a kind of a sets of choices that people have. And there was a beautiful image that the English scholar Francis Bacon used to use, talked about. He said a house with one language is a house with one window. It lets in a certain amount of light. And he said a house with two languages is two windows, so more light is let in. A house, and he said, you know, if there's four or five windows, it says you're inundated with light. You know, so that for me, so I prefer to think of, you know, the House of Dublin, the House of Ireland, as a place of many windows.
Yeah, but there is a problem there, for example, with resources. There was already people that wanted to roll back in the money spent in teaching or supporting Irish. Then if you have more languages to support, that means the cake that was already shrinking has to be divided in more pieces. Then how did the Irish-speaking community, how took that, the fact that there were more languages there, Irish could be diluted more, even in a already seen as monolingual city?
Coming from a Gaelscholar, I don't think that really has anything to do with it. You know, like, as I say, like, the Irish language has survived for a long time and it's been under an attack for numerous reasons over the centuries. And I think any language that comes into Ireland and that's supported by the government or by education is a positive thing in a way, because we can all, especially children, can learn from it and take from it. Over the past few years, my school in particular, we've gone on Yergas projects and we've taken children abroad. And the most amazing thing is when they come back, it's like, I want to learn Spanish. I want to learn more Basque. I can't believe that other child, my new pen pal, speaks Portuguese and Spanish. And I think the more we push this positive aspect of that there are more languages out there that should be learned easily, I think it's great for all the kids. As in, will the Irish language be diluted by losing funding? I think funding's going everywhere anyway, you know. I don't think it's been there. I don't think there's been a language support there good enough for the children in our communities, or strong enough.
For those in primary and secondary education, is the fact that you have kids with other languages, what effect has had in the teaching and learning of Irish?
Well, I think that as teachers, dealing with people who have diverse language skills has made us learn some more about language teaching, about how to approach it. And I think one of the really important things that we've learned is that in the past we taught English, we taught Irish, and to a certain extent we continue to teach languages in their particular boxes. But I think one of the things that we learned over the years is that, you know, to approach the teaching of language in an integrated way, that there are certain skills that you can impart, that you can encourage, that people can learn, no matter what language they're speaking. And for me, that's one of the most important things as teachers that we've learned over the last number of years, because it means that whatever skills you have as a French teacher or as a teacher of Irish or whatever, you can bring those to bear on whatever language it is that you're teaching. And as far as the Irish language is concerned, I think that what we've learned from the multilingual scenario is maybe a slightly different way to approach our Irish teaching. And what I've seen in my own school is, with the children themselves, that from quite a young age, because they are surrounded by people who speak a variety of languages, the whole notion of what language is has become explicit for them. And I remember hearing two little girls in third class talking about language one day, and one saying to the other, "I just want to know, is English a language?" And they couldn't answer this between them. And they said, "Teacher, is English a language?" And the teacher said, "Yes, of course it is." And then this little girl said, "But I'm Irish, what's my language?" And this raised the whole question of our own language in Ireland being Irish, and where children are sitting beside others who have Spanish as their language, Polish as their language, they actually want to have their language as well. And it has been having a multilingual school has actually had a very, very beneficial effect, we have found, in raising children's appreciation of the Irish language. And I think one of the major things has been also that the children have begun to understand that whatever language you speak, it is a means of communication, and that Irish falls into that category as well. So much so that we had children coming down to the shop to buy their pencils or erasers or whatever it was, and asking for these products in Irish. And the secretary came in to me one day and she said, "I've actually enrolled on an online course to improve my Irish because I want to be able to answer them in Irish when they come down." And I think for her, it was probably the first time she actually had a context within which she could use the Irish language. So I think, depending on how we handle this situation, it has huge benefits for the learning of Irish, for the learning of languages in general.
Secondary schools are producing multilingual speakers, or are still producing monolingual English speakers with bits and pieces of this language or the other language that they took in secondary level?
I think there are very few of us who are as far ahead as Deirdre is. Deirdre and her school are an exceptional school in that they're teaching languages in a very integrated way. And I don't think we've reached that yet at post-primary level, but we're about to do it because we're the Council of Europe is coming to Ireland in October, and they're going to train 14 teachers and hopefully 3 or 4 teacher trainers in the whole area of plurilingualism and intercultural competences. And what they're trying to do is to facilitate teachers to change the way they deliver all education in the classroom, to actually capitalise on the fact that they have a plurilingual classroom in front of them, and secondly, to learn how to put scaffolding in place so that the students, as Deirdre said earlier, the students, they don't come with a blank page. They come with all the information that they have learned in school, in their own countries, and a lot of the time we tend to ignore that and bring them back to basics. And what we have to learn to do is to clue into that, if you like, by providing scaffolding for the children so that they can access English learning through their own language. We teachers have to learn how to do that.
But still there is that view out there that we speak English, with English you can go in everywhere. Is that still a kind of proud monolingual image there among many people in Ireland? It's not that true.
I don't know if it's a question of pride. I think it's a question to some extent of kind of just linguistic laziness and the fact that, you know, there's not a lot of people pointing out that this, in fact, is not true. One of the things you find, for example, and this comes, you know, up again and again and again in any of the reports that FirstFoss does, when they look at kind of future skills needs of the Irish economy and so on, it's multilingualism, multilingualism, more multilingualism. I mean, people talk about, you know, jobs in science and technology and so on. In fact, there's far more jobs to be had in the kind of multilingual area. It's much more important than future job creation in science and technology. But, you know, this is a kind of little known fact, but it's actually not, it is a fact that's known to people who are researching, you know, where we're going as a country and economy and so on. So I think that that's, you know, it simply isn't true. I mean, English will allow you to kind of, you know, skim the surface of the world, but if you stop anywhere for any period of time, you're soon in trouble linguistically. So the case for that is made more frequently, and I think it will in times of austerity, that there will be a greater realisation that there are kind of limits to knowledge that's just provided by English alone.
I think that we run out of time. Thanks, Deirdre, Michael, Mary, and A. That will be all. Thanks a lot. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Now, let's visit Dublin and hear firsthand what the people in the streets know about the multilingual history of the city they live in.
How long ago would you say started to be a common thing to hear more than three languages in the streets of Dublin? 10 years ago, 100 years ago, or 500 years ago?
I don't know. The options are very, I would say, like 20 years ago.
10 years ago.
Since 2004.
It's in three options. That maybe it's 100 years.
100 years ago.
100 years ago. 10 years ago.
500 years ago.
100 years ago.
100 years ago.
500 years ago.
10 years ago.
But to say there was many languages being spoken, that really is only in recent time.
I would say 100 years ago.
About 20 years ago.
We say 10 years ago.
Now, let's hear Dr. Michael Cronin give us the answer.
We find in the very origins of the city of Dublin the kind of traces of these different languages. Dublin has always been a multilingual, it's always been a polyglot city.
Dakit se pasa ikendan azken aldi ontan jenti azidala Tantza iken sarritan Zerbait ikusteko adubi falta direla kotz bekuento generalean Sarri.
Next week we will start our round of some of the different language communities coexisting in Dublin in the 21st century. We will have the opportunity to listen to an Spanish, an Arabic and a German speakers currently living in Baia Ajaclia or Babel Ajaclia, as we like to call it in this program. This program was produced and presented by Iñaki Irigoyen with the help of Thomas and Katia. And remember, you can listen to the podcast of this program in the webpage of NIAR FM, www.niar.ie.
This program was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.